Hey everyone, this is Valerie, and I wanted to give you a heads up that this interview was recorded on location at the Specs off of Airport Boulevard, which is a warehouse type situation. And I did my best to fix the audio quality so that you would get the same usual top-notch interview that you're used to. And this one's a really important one to listen to. Our guest has a lot of great things to say about nurturing and creating a positive comedy scene when you're in a new place. And I think you'll want to forgive some of the audio quality in order to listen to what Christine has to say. Welcome to another episode of Comedy Wham Presents with me, your host Valerie, and we were on location, so there wasn't a Miss Purrington for this one. ComedyWham.com is your place to go for features about all Austin comedy, including those passing through. I was on location at Altercation Festival 2018. ComedyWham.com brings you articles and podcasts featuring the best in Austin comedy in all its shapes and formats. Started in 2016, the podcast project brings you funny people and their stories. And as a fan, I like to delve into a comic's background and motivations, and we usually take a detour along the way. Consider the interview a way for you to get to know the folks that make the Austin comedy scene one of the best in the country. Our guest this week has quite an impressive resume. You've seen her on Portlandia. She performed at Edinburgh Fringe Festival and lived to tell about it. She has several podcasts, one of which I highly recommend, and that is called Levine Large. She is currently appearing on The Frank Show, which is a radio show based out of Tucson, Arizona. Our guest grew up in the Portland, Oregon comedy scene for many, many years before moving to Tucson, Arizona. And this interview is pretty important from the perspective of learning the do's and don'ts of how to nurture a positive comedy scene. And from that perspective, that's probably one of the most valuable things you'll get out of listening to our guest. So without further ado, please enjoy this week's episode.
I am so excited. Please, now, Comedy Wham presents our guest, Christine Levine.
Oh, my gosh. Oh. That is a heck of an introduction. Thank you so much.
You're very
That's awesome.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You have an amazing story. I did not realize some of the background that you have. And I will tell you that whenever I start these interviews, I always ask an icebreaker question.
Okay.
And that is one word to describe your past.
Busy. Yes. Very, very busy.
Yeah. And that comes out on stage because one of the things that you talk about very openly on stage is you're a mom of three children.
Mm-hmm.
And you have done quite a lot of hustling in your life to support
mm-hmm.
those children.
Anything I could, yeah.
Yeah. And you're also associated with the whole Doug Stanhope. By covering Altercation Festival, I'm realizing like he creates this family,
mm-hmm.
And you're part of that family.
Yeah, I'm lucky that way. Yeah. I mean, Doug's been really good to us. It's just like he picked comics. I don't think he planned it to build a cult,
yeah.
or whatever, or family if you want to call
yeah.
it, like a Manson type situation. But we're aware that that is what it kind of
yeah.
feels like sometimes. But I think it started early on in like 20 years ago, maybe 20, 21 years ago when I first met Doug.
Uh-huh.
It was like he just picked comics that he thought had potential mm-hmm. or that he wanted to see more of
yeah.
and that he thought he could use his position to like elevate and help get other people to see us, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what he wanted to do. So I think so anyway. And then it just sort of became that we all became very, very close, like a tight-knit, like
mm-hmm.
a family.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, it is. And it feels that way too. But sometimes I take Doug aside and I go, we're going to kill a guy one day, right? Like we are going to.
Is that on the bucket list? The family
bucket
list?
It just feels like.
One day,
something, you know, it's just going to happen.
Yeah. You heard it here first.
And we didn't do it.
Yeah.
And none
I'm
of us
not,
will,
yeah.
No, all of us will be like, well, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, we'll have to pull this episode. When you know the episode has been pulled, you'll know that
some shit went sideways.
This has been subpoenaed.
We laugh, but.
Do you have any early comedic memories? Things that stand out from growing up?
Yes. Okay, so my mother was an alcoholic. and a waitress. She worked at the Crab Bowl in Portland, Oregon. And she left me alone a lot. So I watched a lot of television, but I was always gravitating towards stuff that was, I mean, funny and and female. Like, I watched a lot of Carol Burnett and Lucille Ball and then Saturday Night Live. When I, like, even 7 years old, I would sneak up at night. And I knew if my mom came home in the middle of the night, she saw me up, I would get the shit beat out of me. And I was still just like, but this is worth it. Like, laughing like this is worth it. Yeah. It's worth the risk of her hurting me. And it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And so those were my memories. Yeah. I mean, I always was drawn to anything funny, anything to, like, alleviate pain. Or not think about it, or
an escape.
I mean, yeah, almost, definitely an escape. Yeah,
And if anybody watches comedy, there's definitely that element of there's a lot of pain there that you know you're coping with, dealing with. So is everybody else. And by
that is the thing. Like, I noticed that when artists share that kind of stuff, it helps heal other people.
Yeah.
And so I never tried to hide it. I know it's a cliche, like, oh, the painful, the, you know, the comic that's miserable or whatever. Yeah. Oh, the crying clown. Oh, what a stereotype. It is a cliche. But it, in my case, it is also a real thing. And I love to share my misery or anything awful that, like, I have a whole bit. My husband left me for a woman he met on StarTrek.com, which is, I mean, my first husband. I was married once. When I was 18, and then we were married 18 years, and he met this lady on StarTrek.com.
Wow.
Yeah, and then one day he goes to Australia after 18 years of marriage, and in a way, I was like, oh my God, what a nightmare, of course. I was gutted.
Yeah, yeah.
But thank God I'm a comedian, because then the other part of me was like, this is going to be a great 10 minutes. Like, I can't get better than this. StarTrek.com, are you shitting me?
Yeah.
That was just a gift.
Yeah.
And so I feel sorry for people that don't have comedy, because you're right, everybody's going through pain. Everybody's hurting. Mm-hmm. But at least I have this.
Right.
And at least I can give this to them. Because everybody has.
When did you recognize that?
Probably early on. Like I said, my mom was, beating me up and drinking all the time and leaving me alone. When she was home, she was hitting me. So it was
so
just
you were taking it in.
Yeah.
When did you realize that you could share that?
Well, I think that I had friends, you know, who were kind of going through some tough stuff too. Because you know, I had my other kid friends were, you know, none of us. Well, how do I say this? Like, they all had shitty parents. All my friends had shitty parents.
Yeah.
But I was the one that would come in and be like, hey, guess what? We're going to be all right. Aww. And then I'd do little skits with them or perform for them or tell jokes or just be a goof just to make them laugh. And that's when I first, you know, really realized that, oh, this, when I, watching television, that healed me. And then I would act out and be funny and then try to heal them, I guess.
Yeah.
I just always tried to make them feel better so that they wouldn't cry too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember your first time on the stage? Or what got you to the stage for the first time?
Well, I was a stay-at-home mom for a long time because we got married, like I said, at, like, really young.
Yeah.
And then I just would go to parties and people would be like, "You're so," I'd hold court. And I didn't even know what I was doing, but people go, "You're so funny, you should do stand-up." And by the way, if somebody tells you at a party that, oh, you should do stand-up, it's not the same thing.
Right.
I found that out the hard way. Like, dumb people who tell you that don't know that that's not the same thing. Yeah. And they're stupid. But it wasn't the same. It's totally not. But I did always feel kind of drawn to it. Like I said, it seemed like that was where my direction was going anyway. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, when I first found out that I was having my first baby, I thought, oh my God, I'm never going to be a comedian now. Like, I have to do this baby. Mm. This baby's important. And now whatever I wanted is not important.
Yeah.
So I kind of had it in the back of my mind. And then, like, I went to a psychic lady one time because I got lost. I was dumb. And, like, when I was, like, maybe I was 22 or 23. And she said, so she did my little tarot cards or whatever. And then she goes, she starts clapping. And then she starts laughing. And she goes, I know you're going to be on a stage and people are clapping and laughing. And I don't know if you're a teacher or what this is, but you're like, you're like talking to people and sharing stuff with them and telling them how to do stuff. And I go, oh, Jesus. And I started crying. I was just like, this isn't supposed, this is a joke. Like, yeah. I'm supposed to be going here because I just, it's a last ditch effort and I don't think it's real. And I still am weirded out by that, but I still also go, oh, maybe I said something or tipped her off somehow. I don't know how she knew it, but she did. I don't know. And I thought, yeah, okay, maybe I can still do it. You know what I mean? And then one day, yeah, and then another time, and then I was, the last time I was at a party and somebody said, you know what you should do? And I said, stand-up comedy? Shut up. Shut up. And then I realized, oh, you're being a bitch to that person because you're not doing what you know you're supposed to be doing. And so I was like 29 years old at that point, and I had two kids. No, I had three kids. All three kids were born by then. And I was like, I just got to just go to an open mic. And so I went to an open mic, and I was awful. Completely blanked out. I didn't know.
How did you prepare?
Well, I just thought I was supposed to, like, tell a funny story or tell, like, I mean, I had kids, and I worked at a porn store at that time. So how else, I've got stuff for days. What are you talking about? I mean, my dad was fine. Like, I just had thought I had a whole bunch of stuff in my hopper that I could just, like, I made people laugh when I'm in line at the grocery store. I got this.
Yeah.
And then, no, I just clammed up and I didn't know what I was doing. And it was awful, awful, awful.
Okay.
It was terrible.
Because part of me is curious, was it that way because people didn't, like, there's a lot of pain in some of the things that you do today.
Mm-hmm.
Was it not well received because the people didn't know what to do if you were telling, like, kind of
stories,
or was it really you?
So, in the beginning, you know, my first time, I just literally blanked out. And then this lady comes, but I had fought so hard to get there because I had really bad stage fright. So I was shaking, and I completely froze up and didn't know what to do. And then somebody just yells out, tell a knock-knock joke. And I go, I don't listen to my kids. I don't have one. I don't have a knock-knock joke. Yeah. And then I was like, but I don't know. And then I just said, listen, I have very bad stage fright. I have fought to be here, and I'm going to stand up here for the whole 3 minutes, and I know you're going to hate it, but you know what? I'm going to get drunk later, and I'm going to forget it. So if I don't remember it, it didn't happen, but let's just get through this, okay?
Yeah.
Let's get through this damn 3 minutes. And that is how I got through that 3 minutes, is just like talking to them. But it was a bomb. It was absolutely the worst ever, ever, ever. And then this lady came up to me afterwards. She was another comedian. And she goes, oh, my God, you stood up. You did stand up there for the whole 3 minutes. She goes, I would have run away. She goes, why are you even still here? Because I hung out at the bar afterwards and I watched the rest of the show. Anyway, but the pain part that you're talking about didn't come up till later when I started writing material and figuring this out. I realized quickly that I was a lot for the audience, and I didn't have the skill level to talk about the things that I wanted to talk about and still make it funny.
Yeah.
So I came out of the gate real raw. Like, and I see comics like that too all the time. Now I recognize that where I see what they want to do, but they do not have the skills to pull it off yet. Mm-hmm. Or Ron White says he takes the teeth out of stuff. Like, he makes it more, you know, easier to digest, which there's a lot of stuff that I do that is a little difficult to digest, but hopefully I kind of do it. I kind of massage it in such a way that we get it. They can get it down.
Yeah.
And if they're laughing, then I'm doing my job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know why. It's the worst kind of comedy to do. Why can't I just make jokes about cereal? Why? Why not? Why? It's so much better. But I love kicking water up a hill. And I love, like you said, I want to share that shit so that other people can relate to it and identify with it, or I don't know, make fun of it in their own life. To me, it helps. It helps me.
Yeah.
Makes me a happier person.
Yeah. What year did you start?
1999.
Okay. All right. So you're coming in on your
20th year.
20
oh, yeah.
Year. Mm-hmm. When did you recognize that you needed some practice at telling the harder stuff?
Oh, it was right away. I think I would only certain people would find what I did was funny, and I would see the look on the faces of the other people. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, huh, well, this isn't going, because I think this shit's hilarious.
Yeah.
I think, you know, talking about, let's see, I had one of my first jokes I ever wrote was I had an abortion. Mm-hmm. And my cousin goes, oh my God, Chrissy, you killed your baby. And I said, fuck yeah, I killed my baby. You know what, if the other kids knew that, I bet they'd clean their rooms faster. Well, my first joke. And when I see there was only certain people that thought that was funny, yeah. and then the rest of the crowd would be like mortified. What? Who is this monster? And so seeing that, and then, I just figured out like, oh, there has to be a different way to do this. There's mm-hmm. there's got to be a way to make everybody think it's funny
yeah.
or reach more people.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I was selling out at all because I was still doing what I wanted to do, but just somehow finding the right words and the right tone. And it's a lot more work. It's everybody says, oh, you work clean and then you can work, or working dirty is just, or blue, or whatever it is mm-hmm. that I'm trying to do. That is so, there's, it's so easy, and it's just shock value, or people try to dismiss it all the time.
Right.
And, but I'm like, no, it's way harder to get the room on your side when you're talking about awful things.
Yeah.
It's way harder.
I've been thinking about this a lot lately because, personally, I don't talk a lot about personal mm-hmm. stuff on this, but, I'm going through something, and there's comedy there,
mm-hmm.
but the thing that is really difficult to do is I've seen amazing comics who do this, and I'm like, how do you pull this off? And it's, you tell like the worst story, like just something really awful,
mm-hmm.
but then you, and so the audience is with you for that sad ride,
mm-hmm.
but then you figure out like just the right masterful turn or punchline that tells them it's okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm on the other side of this. It's okay to laugh. Like giving an audience permission to laugh mm-hmm. when you have just like spilled your guts
yes.
in a tough yep. way.
When I talk about, like, I have a bit where I talk about my husband, for example, leaving me mm-hmm. for the lady he met on StarTrek.com. Right away, that's funny. But when it happened, let's see, I started trying to do a bit about it. Because inherently, I know that is a bit that yeah. is going to be funny. Yeah. So I started working on it, you know, pretty much right away.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but the audience was not with me at all. Because even though I thought, like, I know it's funny, my instincts are like, that's funny.
Because you've processed it, too.
Right. But I wasn't ready to talk about it. And they were, like, they could tell. Mm-hmm. There was something that I was doing, and I didn't know what, that they could tell, I think, that I was still in it. Mm-hmm. That I was not mm-hmm. over it yet. And maybe... And this happened 10 years ago, and I have just now started to be able to get it to where it is really funny, because like he tried to kill himself at the end of it, like at the end of our marriage, and that is all part of this bit, but nobody wanted to hear that part. But now I figured it out. Now I got it. Now yeah. And now I'm ready, definitely ready to talk yeah. about it, and the bit's working out.
Yeah.
And I should have done it last night, I guess, but I didn't.
I mean, what you did, just...
but it takes years, is what I mean. Sometimes yeah. it takes years, and sometimes the audience will tell you when you're ready, even uh-huh. if you think you are, or, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? If they're not laughing, then that's not, something's wrong.
Yeah. I've heard that Portland has an amazing comedy scene.
Mm-hmm, they do.
And was that something that was present for you when you first started?
No.
Or was that
I like to think I was in it while we were growing it, and uh-huh. I like to think that I helped foster it a
yeah.
little bit. I hope I did.
Yeah.
I mean, they call me the comedy mom, and they call me, my nickname is Mamu. Like, everybody, my kids were calling me that. And uh-huh. then, so I think Stanhope started calling me Mamu. And then, like, even the comic, there's a comic, Adam Posse, who came to see me last night. He's from Portland, uh-huh. just visiting Austin and doing shows here. And he was calling me Mamu, and I was like, oh my God, my Portland nickname. That's so cute.
Oh.
I just needed to hear it. It was so nice. But yeah,
and that explains the show that you started in Tucson.
No, I started it in Portland actually. Yeah,
oh, you did.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe it was just making its premiere. What I
yep.
was reading was
That's
it was
right.
making its premiere in Tucson.
Yeah, I started it in Portland. That critical comedy is
yeah.
what you're talking about. Yeah, and it was just an idea to start fostering. Like when I first started doing comedy, we very much had like a mentorship or apprenticeship type.
Mm.
Way of doing things, like, you know, one of the bigger comics would take a little junior comic and, you know, and take them under their wing and
yeah.
be like, hey, I'll show you how to work the road. I'll show you how these jokes work. I'll show you, you know, what bookers to talk to, what bookers are going to treat you nice, what ones are going to treat you bad, what ones are going to provide rooms for you or gas mileage or, you know, all these perks
yeah.
and pitfalls, you know. And then, I don't know, maybe as the internet sort of got bigger, I think, and people were not as apt to go on the road, and they wanted jobs as writers, or they wanted to go to LA or whatever, mm-hmm. the road stuff kind of died out. And that, and with that, the mentorship, the, you know, pairing up the comics, like helping each other sort of phased out.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I missed that. So in order to spark that up again, I started this critical comedy thing where, like, I handpick these comics that I like or that I think have potential or I want to see grow. Uh-huh. And, and not just me, but like maybe a couple other comedians will go, hey, you should have that person. And then, so we get them together, maybe like 10, and they perform. I bring an audience because I'll do a bit too that is awful. And I'll do something new too. So I bring an audience. Uh-huh. And then they get to perform for like, I give them like 7 to 10 minutes, which is a good chunk of time for like a whatever, quote unquote, open mic. And then they do their bit, and then the other comedians in the audience and sometimes the audience members themselves, I let them give them talking, like pointers and like maybe taglines or directions that they could go or just any kind of critique.
Yeah.
But it has to be positive. You can't just say, keep your day job, you suck. And there are some stuff, like I had like a guy who wanted to imitate Sam Kinison and lay on the ground and shout and whatever. And I just was like, nope, you're done. That's it. Get off my stage. No. Well, this is open mic. No. No, it's not. No, I made a mistake. I should not have booked you on this. And nope, you have to go. Bye. So there's been sometimes. Sometimes people are just terrible. And you just have to tell them, no, that's awful and that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. This one lady, she shouted the N-word and the F-word just over and over and over again. And then I just go, oh, cut the mic. And I was like, no. I go, she goes, what, you don't like free speech? And I go, oh, Jesus.
Oh.
I love free speech. I'm not a communist.
Have you seen my act?
Right? But what you're doing you may think is provocative, mm-hmm. but it is not funny. So it is not comedy.
Yeah.
You might be doing a performance piece, but or a performance art or whatever you think you're doing, but that's not what I'm here to help you with.
Yeah.
So you need to go. So I'm really kind of, I mean, there is like a mean streak about it. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not always like super nice, but overall, try to keep it really positive and moving, you know, uplifting and trying to help people and not shit on them.
Yeah.
Not too much, no. But you can't just yell out bad words.
Yeah.
I don't allow it.
As a matriarch to your own proper family, you mentioned touring. I imagine the touring was not possibly in your cards.
No, I didn't get to do it very often because of the fact that I was raising a family and then, of course, StarTrek.com, whatever. So it did.
They're getting way too many plugs.
Oh, no, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Screw them.
For their role in your life.
Oh, God.
I'm going to beep.
Thank you. That is such a, like a dating website for nerds.
Oh,
who knew?
God.
Well, anyway, yeah, thank you. Yeah, edit it. Sorry. But they
never edit. So.
Oh, good. Even better. All right. Well, they do suck. What would they say? Oh, yeah. So I did. I was like tied down a lot. But that's where like Doug comes in because Doug Stanhope, you know, he did what I was trying to do with other comedians. Mm-hmm. I just picked people that I liked, and that's what he did. So he liked me, I guess, and then he would try and take me on the road and got me to Edinburgh and got me to do all kinds of stuff that, like, to Amsterdam, took me places I would never get to go just because he liked what I did. And I think by now, like me as a person, but I just remember back then it was just all about the comedy and he just thought I was funny, I think.
Yeah.
I hope.
How did he get on your radar? Is he from the Portland?
No.
Yeah.
His current lady, Bingo, is from from Oregon,
okay.
But and kind of Portland-ish. But no, he... we actually met online we used to all belong to this comedy group. Remember Usenet? Do you remember back in the day, like a long time ago, right? Like 20 years ago. Anyway, we both belong to Alt Comedy Stand Up, and we call it ACS. And we all still talk to each other, by the way. Like, we're all still friends. We have a Facebook group. And we have an ACS Facebook group. And Doug was on that. And so one time there was like we all got together. We had a little festival of our own at the Hollywood Improv. And that's how we all met. And that was like in 90. You know what? It might have been 98. 1998 or maybe 99. I always say 99, but I'm thinking like it might have been the year before now that I think about it.
So that means your first open mic was before 99.
Yes, probably. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If I was there. Yeah. Now that I think about it. But I just remember getting started in 99. You know what I mean? Like before. Because I remember being 29 years old and I was working at the porn store. And I remember the person that I worked with, I was like, oh, God, I'm turning 30 and I'm doing stand-up and blah, blah, blah. And this guy I works with, he goes, you do stand-up comedy? And I go, I know, I'm not funny, am I? And he goes, no, what? He couldn't believe it. And that is why I know about when I started, because I remember telling this asshole, like, oh, I'm turning 30. And he was like, ugh, and you do comedy? No. Terrible. But anyway, that's how we all met. We were doing this like little festival thing in LA, and then we became friends after that. Like we had room parties and started hanging out, and then I don't know. Yeah. But that was a long time ago. I mean, that was before he became, I guess, what he is now, which is a thing.
Yeah.
He's quite a thing now.
Yeah.
I understand. I'm told. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't get it, but.
All right, so you have this collegial group,
mm-hmm.
and you're working your butt off in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
When do you start going through the litany or the typical comic experience? I'll say typical. There was no typical.
Mm-hmm.
You start hosting your own show. I don't know when critical comedy started.
Oh, like 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, not a long time ago.
Okay.
There's like the levels that you're supposed to go through. Like you're supposed to do open mic, mm-hmm. right? And then you start hosting shows or showcases.
Yeah.
So that you're the low dog on the totem pole. And then you start featuring and then you start headlining. Well, my plan was I am never going to host a show in my life, not host like proper, like, and your next comic coming up to the stage, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Ugh, I hate that. I just never wanted to be that guy. All I want to do is comedy.
Okay. All right.
All I want to do is stand up. And so the person who has to take the bullet, the very first comic that you see being the host of the show, nope, I skipped that. So I just went to open mics until somebody started, they wanted to book me as a feature. So I had to do 30 minutes. But because I stayed as an open micer for so long, I had 30 minutes. I had more, like, I was great. Like, okay, I'm ready.
Uh-huh.
And then I started, like, quote-unquote headlining when nobody wanted to book me as a feature anymore. I just waited. I just, I don't know. I just kept going to open mics until people didn't want to follow me anymore.
Yeah.
And then I have to go on last now, and which is awful because I like to have a couple drinks, do a little time, go the fuck home. But now I have to wait. I have to get there the time the show starts. I mean, it's just so much work. And there's a lot of pressure, too, because what if nobody comes? You're the guy on the poster, and what if nobody comes to see you?
Yeah.
It's terrible. It's the worst job ever. Ugh. I didn't ever want that. No, I never had a goal. Uh-huh. I never tried. I never said, oh, I'm going to be, I'm gonna be Queen Bee. I'm gonna be Queen Turge this shit mountain. That never occurred to me.
I'm hearing such like this conflict though, because you were like, well, I'm never gonna host the show.
Mm-mm.
So you have that, you know, set.
Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna be the guy that opens it. Yeah. I don't want to be the lady that does the first part, and I didn't want to be the one to do the last part.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe I did, but I didn't realize the pressure that I would feel.
Yeah.
Now that I'm here, kind of, unless there's somebody, you know, like Doug or like somebody much, much, much bigger than, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But for in my world, like, in club world, I guess, like B room world.
Yeah.
I'm usually the last person on, I guess, now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is funny to hear you say that, because when you came on stage last night, it did feel like you didn't want to be up there.
It was incredible. Well, it was such a sweet intro, and I just felt like, oh, Jesus, I better not fuck this up.
But by the end, you have this, like, in your hands and in your clutches, and it's like, oh, she knows what she's doing. She's not this reluctant, you know.
Well, I do know. Once I get there, I feel like you're right. Like, I got this. Like, I do have that feeling of, like, oh, because I know what's coming, and I know what we're going, and I love the fact that you don't.
Yeah.
And I hope that I have a confidence. Because, like, when I tell people I do critical comedy with, like, if you have that confidence, they'll put their trust in you. Right. And it's almost like, comedy is almost like tickling a toddler. You know, if a toddler doesn't trust you, they will not laugh. Right. They won't, they'll just quail or recoil. And that is what people, that's how grown-ups are in comedy. They just, the audiences, will not go with you if that trust isn't built. So I have to trust them that they're going to like me and that I'm okay. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I put my little tenders out like, hi, do you like me?
Yeah.
And then they say, ha, 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 hi, I like you too. And then that trust for both of us builds, I think. And then by the end, I think we're all in a better place. Yeah, I hope.
Yeah,
that's my goal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as a fan, I will tell you the compliment to what you just said. You had built that trust with me, and I'm a parent too. So when you started talking about the bathtub story, and I'm not going to do spoilers. I don't know if this is on an album.
It is on one.
Okay,
the only album I have.
Okay. I will say that I think because I am a parent, I knew where this was. Story was going.
Yes.
But I actually, in my mind, was like, I trust her. I am so excited for how she's going to get me to this punchline because I know exactly where this is going because I'm a parent.
You're uncomfortable. And this is going to be bad. But what is she? Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you said that because I've seen women, mothers, walk out.
Oh, I'm sure.
They don't know what is happening at the end, but they just know, nope, I'm out. Mm-mm.
I mean, but if you can't laugh at parenting nightmares, not even nightmares, just parenting scenarios that you find yourself in. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that every once in a while on Facebook, I might say something like, words I never thought I would say. Mm-hmm. Please take the boot out of the jelly. You know,
yes,
just never.
Exactly. One time I had one of those situations. I asked my 15-year-old son, Christopher, one time, when he was 15, I go, Christopher, can I see you for 2 seconds? Hello. And I held an empty jar of, like, cinnamon.
Uh-huh.
And I said, did you eat my cinnamon? And it was so weird because remember they had that cinnamon challenge on the internet?
Uh-huh.
This was before that.
Oh, God.
And so I didn't understand what was happening at all. And he goes, no, I didn't eat cinnamon. And he had cinnamon, like, all over his face. And he's 15 and he was 6 foot tall. He was like a giant boy. And I go, really? I said, Christopher, I am your mother. You've known me for a long time now. I don't ask a question that I don't already know the answer to.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was so crazy. It was like, there's not even cinnamon sticks. Yeah. What are you doing? Did you just like spoon it tiny bits and eat it or put it in something? Why are you eating my cinnamon? What is wrong with you? And it was, that's one of those things where I never thought I would be like, did you eat the cinnamon?
Yeah.
Out of nowhere? Why? And he said, I don't know. He said, I just wanted to taste it. Yeah. And I got crazy.
Yeah. Oh,
so I get it. Yeah,
stories.
It's so stupid.
Yeah.
So kids are dumb.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah. That's why they have us, because they are stupid.
Speaking of kids, you have a podcast with your kids.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Yeah. And it's still out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that I did that. I loved hearing that. Sometimes I'll listen to it just for my sake, just so I can hear their voices again when they were younger. And, I miss them.
Yeah, because they're still in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and they're 28, 25, and 21 now. Mm-hmm. So we did that podcast when they were maybe 22 and 18 and, 15 or 16, I think, Joshie was. Yeah, so we did a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I leave them up because I love their stories, and I love listening to that phase in our lives. When I moved to Tucson, I saw a mom walking around with a tall, 18-year-old son, because I live University of Arizona, like, neighborhood, you know? And so she's taking her kid to college for the first time, and she's buying him all his stuff, like frozen pizzas and Mountain Dew, all the shit that he's going to need. She's buying him groceries, and they are laughing, like, gut laughing down like a frozen food aisle. And I pushed my cart and I saw them and I froze myself and I just started crying because I'm like, I used to laugh like that with my kids and I miss that.
Yeah.
And it's so much that you love your kids just because they're your babies, you know, when they're little, you know, that's my, I love them because you're taking care of them and stuff and that's your job. But it's so, it's different when they become people that you love. Like, they you love them just because they're amazing and they're smart and they're funny,
yeah,
and you would choose them. That is a gift not a lot of parents have, and I am so blessed that I have that.
Yeah.
I love my kids like they're my family, like my chosen family.
Mm-hmm.
They're the same to me. Yeah. Mm-hmm, I got blessed. And so I do this podcast because I wanted to show people, I think, so that they would understand.
Yeah.
Because I think I think my parenting, the dynamic I have with my kids is something that a lot of people can't understand.
Yeah.
And I think until you hear the podcast, then it makes more sense, mm-hmm, I think.
Yeah.
It's like a companion piece to my comedy. Right? Is that it?
Yeah. Well, and you are your parent. You're a comic. You know, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't separate things sometimes.
No.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. It's all about. Yeah. It's all my life through my filter.
Yeah.
That's it. Mm-hmm. If I don't have a filter, I don't know why I even use that word. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious to talk to you about Edinburgh.
Okay.
Because Edinburgh wasn't on my radar as a thing until maybe 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We talked before we were recording. Most everyone knows I'm a hardcore fan of Dave Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been to Edinburgh several
yes.
times. So that's
yeah.
how I found out mm-hmm. about this festival. You were in Edinburgh in 2012
right.
with a show.
Mm-hmm.
And I warned you up beforehand. I said, I usually don't go negative mm-hmm. on this podcast, but I wanted to talk about this because you got negative reviews
mm-hmm.
from that show that you did.
I did.
And I just wonder, like, I imagine you have a pretty thick skin.
Yeah, I didn't. When I saw those reviews, I stayed in bed all day.
Oh.
And it was hard. The publicist I was there with, Julie Seabaugh, had to talk me out of bed. Like, it was hard. It hurt really bad. But what helped me, and what she actually pointed it out, she goes, you need to read the comments in the comment mm. section. That's what you have to read. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then it started with, like, these women from Ireland were, like, it was the Guardian review that was the worst.
Yeah.
And they hammered me for being, you know, just dirty for dirty's sake, or,
right.
like, shock, whatever, and they just did not get it. And these Irish women were like, whoa, the bougie Guardian doesn't get a working class woman just mm-hmm. talking about shit in her life. Well, yeah, of course you guys would hate her.
Yeah.
And they were all like, she sounds like that's our girl.
Oh.
And that did cheer me up because
yeah.
then it started this whole conversation about working class women and where we fit in entertainment and why no one wants to hear from us
mm-hmm.
because we have a potty mouth.
Yeah.
Like, it's still weird like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that just because I use certain language or I talk about certain topics that my whole message or my jokes or everything is getting lost. But I promise, like, my shows didn't feel that dry ever or that unfunny or that shocking
yeah.
or anything. And I didn't even have the bathtub story back then. I mean, wait till they buckle up now, Scotland. You have no idea what's coming now. And I had one journalist, Kate Kopstick, she didn't write about my show, but she did write about, like, how another comedian, a more famous male comedian, had done a show there that at the same time, and he had similar topics and was raunchy and dirty or whatever and got nothing but love. Nothing but love. And she said, come on, you know, what about... Like, there's this other comic, Christine Levine, and then she's getting railed by the Guardian for mm. being dirty. What or why? Mm. And it was a good point. I thought that
yeah.
too, because I don't remember being dirty. I can't even. I'm like, what are they talking about? I do know that they did come and review me kind of early on, and so when you first get somewhere and I've got jet lag and I wasn't like settled, like
yeah.
I was like maybe even a week later in my room because I had my own. Space, and so I had the same time every night for a whole month. So eventually, I got real sharp. You
uh-huh.
get pretty good as the night goes on, as the
sure.
weeks go on. So that first week was just a blur, anyway. But I don't remember. I don't remember. I know the show that they were at, and I'm like, I don't remember it that way.
Yeah,
it didn't suck for me. I did like it.
Yeah.
But yeah, what helped me was reading the comments and that the Irish ladies were like, screw you guys. If you hate her, we love her.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, nice. Maybe it's just the wrong paper for me. Yeah. They were the worst. There were other reviews that weren't great. There was one review that was good that I thought, oh, they liked me. Yeah. That made me feel better a little bit. But it was hard to swallow.
Yeah.
It was really, and then when people do, like, will be like, does that happen? Did you read this? Oh, yeah, thanks. Shh. Just so I just delete. Don't want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still a little, but it did happen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They were mean to me, I know.
Jerks.
Yeah, well, I mean.
But on the other hand, you know, there's other people that come to your sing your praises. I had written down one quote that this was the, So this was an article that Doug wrote.
Mm.
And I pulled two quotes because I thought, yeah, this is what I saw last night. Levine uses coarse language but doesn't rely on shock value. Yeah.
The Guardian should have read that.
Yeah, exactly. And then another one that I really liked is, no matter what you call her, there's a strong chance you'll want to be just like her by the end of the show.
Oh, wow. I forgot that he said that. That's really nice, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's really sweet.
Yeah. And I actually wrote down one, but I have these, like, press things, and I have press bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then I pulled one of the quotes that The Guardian wrote, and I'm like, you're idiots. Do you want me? Can I read this?
Yeah, please do. Yes.
But it's hard to see her gross-out humor and glib humor, spelled with O-U-R, by the way.
Yes.
And glib take on rape and abortion prospering without a rowdier and less beady audience than she got here. And when I read that whole thing, I just realized you're not contextualizing. Like, and I thought it was, okay, this is a Scotland point of view versus, well, in America, this is, like, actually pretty typical from what you see on a comedy stage.
Right.
And I thought, oh, well, it was just that. And then I saw another one that was like, okay, yeah, this person, they got her. They understood what she was saying.
Yeah, but it just seemed like they didn't want to.
Yeah.
Almost. That's how I felt. I thought, you missed the point on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You got so bogged down on my language that you forgot that there was any jokes there. Yeah, and one of the jokes that they're talking about is, well, that first joke that I wrote, the abortion joke, I used that one.
Yeah.
I talked about... let's see, I'm trying to think of the rape thing that they're referring to.
And by the way, I haven't mentioned this, but the title of that show was Fat Whore.
Yes.
What were they expecting to walk into?
That's what I was saying. That is exactly kind of what, well, that's what, actually, Doug called me and he goes, I got a name for your show. And I was like, what? He said Fat Whore. I doubled off. I just fell apart. I was like, yep, that's it. And I'm not, I'm fat, but I'm not necessarily horrible. I have had hoary times in my life. But I thought, no, that's perfect, because it will scare away anybody that isn't down for that. You know what I mean? Like, it kind of, when Mae West had her show Sex in 1925 or whatever, like, anybody that's not into it, it's not going to come.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what I thought, too. I thought, well, it'll just attract my crowd.
Yeah.
Even though, see, my built the room that I was in was like a 700-year-old, poshy, fancy building. I don't know, it was probably a castle or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Everything's a castle there.
Yeah.
Everything looks like the toilets look like they're in castles. It's crazy. It's so weird. Everything is 800 years old.
Yeah.
And that's new.
Yeah.
Like, that's new for them. And so so it had a chandelier in the middle and it was pretty fancy.
Yeah.
And I'm used to doing like dive bars. So I was put off a little bit like that, I think. And they're also, the audiences there are very polite, and they want to, they don't want to bother you with their laughter too much, which is, come on, you guys. It's annoying.
Yeah.
But I did think that I was like, man, Guardian, come on. Give me a break.
Well,
but,
thank you for exploring that part, because it's not often that
I just wasn't their audience.
Yeah.
I mean, I just wasn't their comic.
Yeah.
That is just, sometimes that's how, a little of me goes a long way down memory lane. Mm-hmm. You're just not going to, I'm not for everybody.
Yeah.
That's true. And that is a very important part of comedy, is just finding your audience, or letting your audience find you.
Yeah.
Because I'm not for everybody. Like, what I was wanting to tell you earlier, remember when you asked, like, how did I know that I was too rough?
Uh-huh.
When my parents came to see me. Early on, my parents came. And then I suddenly become very aware of what I'm saying and how it's coming across.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And that is when I was like, oh, you need to figure out a way to have the best of, like, to make these worlds mesh so that you can say what you want without hurting nice people like your mom and dad.
Yeah.
It's my stepmom and my dad, my real dad, who I love, love, love so much. They're the best people. Mm-hmm. But when I saw their faces as to some of the stuff I was saying, I was like, oh, I get it. Yeah, that's what I knew.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting lesson for people, too. There you go. That's a life lesson right there. Hmm. Okay. How did you get involved with Portlandia?
That was really by luck, too. Yeah. I just had been in Portland for so long, and I had done some other acting stuff, like for Oregon Lottery, I did ads for them, and I know, so I was kind of in the casting guy's radar.
Yeah.
And then, so he just called me and said, hey, can you play a fat, like, swinger part of a couple or something? And I said, yes, I can. Yeah, I got it all day.
Yeah.
And then I just kept getting asked back.
Uh-huh.
Every year I thought, oh, I screwed it up. They're never going to ask me back again. And then I would see Carrie and Fred and go, what am I doing here?
Uh-huh.
Oh, man, I keep thinking I'm screwing it up. And they're like, you're fine. You're great, Christine. Aww. Things are going great. Oh, man, you're not reading the same book I am because I think I'm a big fat fuck up. I think I suck. All right. And nobody really knows this, but my TV husband that they paired me up with, Ebby Rose Smith, is a writer. And he wrote that movie Falling Down. With Michael Douglas.
Okay.
It's like from the 90s, I think. And so Michael Douglas plays this, like a business guy or, you know, like middle management type guy. He's got a flat top haircut and he's trying to get across LA to go see his daughter's birthday party, I think, or something like that. And then in the process, he kind of has a meltdown and he freaks out and takes a bat to LA, like freaks out.
Okay, now I remember this movie. Yes.
Uh-huh.
I'm on a major Michael Douglas kick. I just watched The Game this week.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I forgot what other one I watched recently. So I'm going to add.
Well, do watch Falling Down. And anyway, cool. So Evie wrote that. And it's funny. Nobody knew on the set that he had written that movie. Because I Googled him. And I was like, oh, my God, this guy's kind of famous. Uh-huh. He's a big deal. And it seemed like nobody got that.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when I see him, I go, Ebby, you ever just feel like going crazy? You know what I mean? Like you're stuck in traffic and you're like, oh, I can't handle it. And he'd go, no, I never have no idea. Nope. Mm-mm. And then the next year I'd see him again. I go, Ebby, you ever just want to get a bat, bash a convenience store all to hell. Go nuts. Nope. Ebby, you ever think that, like, you're the bad guy? And after years of this and him not budging at all, I finally just told everybody. Everybody on the set. I was like, Ebby wrote Falling Down. He's fancy. He's a great writer. And he wrote this and he wrote that, like a bunch of other stuff. And I told Fred and Carrie. And then next thing I know, I hear them going, Mr. Smith, would you like can I get you some coffee? Oh, yeah. All of a sudden, like I felt like the staff had changed or the, you know, like, what? You, oh my goodness. Yeah. I'm like, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they weren't treating us bad.
Yeah.
But once they found out that he was actually like, he wasn't from Portland and he wasn't just some like doing local summer stock or whatever, he was a real actor and he's a real. Writer.
Yeah.
And it made a difference. And I love that I did that to him.
Yeah.
He didn't want me to out him, but I totally did.
He's great. Given that some of your persona, not some, your persona on stage seems to be, you know, this is who I am. How is it acting? And is it something that you really like? Or is like, you like it as long as Christine can be part of the character.
Yeah, I think I would say I have to be part of the character because I have never done any acting where I play somebody else.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that would be like or look like for me. So I've never had to do it. So, because everything I get cast in is just, I feel like I would be like the Melissa McCarthy. Mm. You know what I mean? I would just be me in every, put me in some weird situation and then maybe it would be funny and, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I've never really explored acting other than that.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Oh, I did do one time I was in second grade. I was the Ghost of Christmas Past. But then I got sick, and then Alicia Geiger took my place, and I was real mad about it.
Mm.
Anyway.
It's not that you're holding on to this.
No. Agreement. I wouldn't. If the shoe had been on the other foot, I would not have taken her place. Yeah. There would just be no ghost. But she wants to take my place. That's fine. Cool.
Just for the listening audience, there's a clear, like, facial expression of angry bitterness coming. Yeah.
It's a slow burn. I wouldn't have done it to her. I'm just saying.
You moved from a big, thriving Portland, Oregon comedy scene to Tucson, which I've never heard a word about a comedy scene there.
Yes.
How has that experience been?
Oh, boy.
And how long ago was it?
Okay, so I moved to Tucson 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
And the comedy scene there, I would say there's a lot of raw talent, but there is no real... I just saw the comics, like, floundering, and it took me a while before I dove in and tried to do anything or offer not help, because that seems so, like, oh, here, you guys suck. Yeah. Let me help
I'm
you.
Here.
I'm here now. I've got this.
Yeah.
I don't mean that. I don't even want that. Mm-hmm. But I see, like, they can help each other instead of sitting around going, hey, you're fucking great. Oh, yeah. Like, they're all just jerking each other off. It's so weird.
Yeah.
And then there's this club there, and I don't mind talking shit about this dude at all. He knows I hate his guts. The club owner of Laughs abuses these comedians. Like, he says that he pays them in stage time. Like, he doesn't make them. They will go collect glasses. They'd run the sound. They'll host. They'll do whatever he wants. And then they get, quote unquote, stage time. So he's paying them a stage time. I'm like, you pay them in money.
Right.
You pay, if they're worth giving them stage time, then you pay them in money. What are you talking about? Anyway, so he just treats comics like garbage. He talks shit about comedians all the time.
Why is he running a club?
Because he wants to, he's a glorified nacho salesman. He wants to sell french fries and chicken strips and shitty food and watered down drinks. He doesn't give a shit about comedy or the comics. And the comics are like, I mean, I got there and I was like, you guys are like Stepford Wives. You guys are like got Stockholm Syndrome or something, because they see the problem and they'd be like, yeah, but you know, he's an asshole, but he's our asshole. And I'm like, you don't understand. Every other city has fought this battle with the comedy club when they're the only comedy club in town and has this egomaniac weirdo club owner. And they have won because the comics would stick together and they would say, nope, you're going to treat us right. You're going to treat us with respect. And we're not coming there until, because I try to explain that to them, without the talent, this is a shitty restaurant.
Yeah.
Without us, it is not a comedy club. So he needs you much more than he has ever let on. He's basically been like, I can run this shit without, I don't need you. Well, there's comics all over the place that want to come here. But that's not true.
Yeah.
That's not true.
And touring is going to know, I mean, you guys all know who the good clubs,
right?
Which are the
and
clubs
in my book, in my opinion, Laughs is not one of them. It's a shithole, if you ask me. I mean, as far as clubs go, I mean, is it the Improv? Is it the Stand? Is it or Stand Up Live? Is it any of these great clubs that are Helium? No, by no means. It's like they've been booking the same comics for like 20 years, to the point where, okay, so I work on a radio show now. We don't even want the comics that tour and go there to that club because they've been doing the same material for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So then they come on the radio show and all they do is do the same bits. It's just all hacky and dumb by now.
Yeah.
So, and he doesn't care because he just will pay them, like if he was paying them like $500, you know, 6 months ago, 6 years ago or 20 years ago, he's still paying them $500. Yeah. Nobody's gotten a raise. He doesn't.
Wow.
And this is, by the way, this is just stuff that people have told me. I guess I am being a little, it is what, I know it's true, but it is just what other comics have said to me and how I just hate it. It burns my ass. It burns my ass that the comics, they go through these periods where they will, I'm telling them, I go, you are worth something.
Yeah.
You are. You were worth getting paid. You are worth a man not looking at you and telling you, yeah, you're shit. And, you know, like they'll go, hey, can I get bumped up to host, or can I get a raise, or can I get a little something? I mean, would you at least give us free drinks if we come and do whatever for you? And he'll be like, you know what? I don't need you, or you're not good enough to do it. And they all just want this dude's approval so bad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you are worth it. You are worth something, and you need to act like it, and you need to take control, and you need to tell him, You got to defend yourself. You got to stand up for yourself. I can't do it for you. I have told this guy to fuck off like 1,000 times already. Once to his face. Just, he tried talk. I was there to do a charity show. And I'm lucky that he even let me in to do the show. The next charity show that I was scheduled to do in that building had nothing to do with him, but I was scheduled to do it. He told the charity, for it was breast cancer charity, and like 2 weeks before he said that if they didn't pull me from the lineup that they had to find a new venue.
Holy cow.
So they had to do new posters, new everything, because they already had people knew where to go at least. Yeah. They didn't feel last minute change to that. You know, changing me out was easier than moving the venue, which I don't blame them, because what had happened, he comes out and he was like, he tried to steal he's tried to steal Critical Comedy. He sent this other comic an email just saying like, hey, let's just do Critical Comedy over at Laughs, and how about you do it? And he wasn't even going to pay this dude to do it. Like, what are you doing? And anyway, the guy showed me the email. I'm like, what, who is this monster? Why is he, who's he think he's going to steal my show? And cut me out because Christine just makes it all about her. Oh, Jesus. How do you even make a show like Critical Comedy about me? Anyway.
So Tucson,
but he'd done all that to me and done all that to these comedians. And then he has the balls to act like I'm his friend. He came up to me because there was a bunch of other comics around. He goes, hey, Christine. And I ignored him. And he goes, hey, Christine. And I ignored him again. And then the bartender, he goes, oh, I don't think she can hear you, Mr. Bynum, because everybody kisses his ass and acts real weird around him. And I go, no, I fucking heard him. And I said, you can go fuck yourself. And I was shaking. I was like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you ever, yeah. ever. And then I go, can I have my bag? I was like, please, I have to go. And he got me a bag and I just walked out. And I'm never welcome back. And that's great. It's a badge of honor for me to be kicked out of that shithole. Good. And I tell all the every comic that gets banned from there, I go, come on, we can do this ourselves. Yeah. You don't need this dumpy club. God, if there was just be another club that would come to town. One time, I think an improv was going to come to Tucson, and he found out where they wanted to put their improv, like the building that they wanted.
Yeah.
And he rented it out from under them for a year so that they couldn't go there.
Wow.
So that he wouldn't have competition in Tucson. He bans comics for doing other shows on competing nights. Well, why does that hurt his show or hurt his room at all?
Yeah.
It doesn't do any. If any, the more stage time any comic gets, is good for comedy.
Right.
And the better these comics get, the better they're going to be on your stage.
Yep.
Why wouldn't you want to foster that and support that? But he just shits on him, and it's all a control act, and it's so sick. It's the most dysfunctional comedy scene I've ever seen. Mm. And I have tried to say stuff and tried to speak up, but man, these guys have got to do it for themselves.
Right.
We had to do it in Portland. I was there when we had to do it in Portland, and I was the first one to say, I'm never working for Harvey's. I'm never doing that. I didn't begrudge anybody that wanted to work for Harvey's, because it was just the same shit. That guy was just a real beast.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, wasn't interested in fostering comics or helping the community at all. All he wanted to do was sell drinks and nachos and shit.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't have any time for that. I knew then the world is changing. And since we have the internet and we have the ability to connect on our own, mm-hmm. we do not need these gatekeepers anymore. And fuck them if they treat us bad. We don't need it. We are entertainers and we are important. And there's a value to what we do.
Yeah.
And we can do it ourselves. We don't need these guys, these nacho cheese salesmen to tell us what to do or whether we're good enough or what our worth is. We can decide that now.
Yeah. I feel like I started this interview talking to Christine, and by
Sorry.
The end, I've gotten Mamu. Now I get it. I get the, you know,
I'm like,
the
no,
nurture,
come
the
on.
Setting up, you know, wanting the best for your kids.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, but there's only so much I can do. This is what I mean. Yeah, this the scene in Tucson. I love these guys. I love these comics, and I see their raw talent, and I think they're amazing, and they could really build something, but they cannot build it with this dysfunction and the sickness and this constant, I can't even describe it really. It's like, dysfunction, I guess. This cloud.
Takes time.
And I just hope that they can get out of it.
Yeah.
I try to offer them, like, my partner, Joey, and I, we try to, put together, we have an open mic, The Mint, and we try to give these comics like lots of stage time. We give them the ability, see, it laughs, they only get 3 minutes on a Thursday. So we have a Tuesday open mic, and we try to give them like as much time as they need to, because to stretch your legs and to get to where you're comfortable and you can start working on, you have jokes and then you have bits, right? So to get those bits worked out so that you can have a chunk of material so that you can get ready to work the road if you want to, that is what we hope to foster.
Yeah.
That is what we want to build. And that's the community that we're trying to help. Mm-hmm. But sometimes comics, like he'll even, Bynum will ban comics that would come to our show, would come to the open mic. It's not even competing, but just because, you know, if he thinks that they like us, then... it's just so weird. But he hasn't banned Joey yet, which is weird. Mm. I am banned, but not him, which is, I can't figure it out.
Yeah.
Bynum's always got a reason. He's always thinking. I know that for sure. So now Tucson has like these two warring factions.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, stay tuned.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I should say I'm not at war anymore.
Yeah.
I was when I got there because I thought, shit, screw this dude.
Yeah.
But now I'm just like, nope, I'm just going to build my own thing. Right. I'm going to do my own stuff and welcome all the comedians that want to be a part of it. And the ones that don't want to, that's okay too. And I just want to, you know, can do what I can for them while I'm there.
Right.
Let's see what I can do.
You're the Harry Potter to the Voldemort.
I feel like I am. I feel like that. Yeah. And also, I co-host a radio show.
Yeah.
The Frank Show. So we do morning radio, and so we have comedians come in that are all the comedians that we have on are producing their own shows or doing independent shows.
Okay.
They aren't affiliated with the club at all or whatever. And even comics I know, they're like, "Hey, I'm working the club. Can I?" Even my friends who have worked laughs, and I go, "No." Mm. No, I can't have you on our radio show. Yeah. We're not going to help him. Not after the way he treats all the people that we love. We can't do that. And they understand.
Yeah.
I'm lucky.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We're going to start wrapping up.
Sorry.
No,
I
that's
did too
okay.
much. I did too much.
No, we're actually doing great.
Okay,
on time.
Okay, babe.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure that people know about? You had in passing mentioned your album, Hey Sailor.
Oh, yeah. I did. I made an album 4 years ago. Oh, we can talk about my lack of business acumen.
Oh.
I have none. And that is, I don't know how to, like, there are so many comedians who, the successful comedians, I think, are not only funny, but they're also good at organizing, like making sure they have their website up, making sure they have business cards, making sure that they follow through with press interviews, which I never do and I'm terrible at, making sure that they, record an album, get it done and finished in a timely manner. They're guys that will work on their comedy and can listen to, they record their sets every night and they go home and they listen to it and they take notes or write notes or have somebody else do that for them, like a partner or a close friend that they trust or another comedian. They have there's a system, you know, there's a bunch of stuff that you should do as a comedian that I have never done. And I'm 48 now and I think, man, what could I have accomplished if I just could have got my shit together?
Yeah.
But I just can't do it. I'm not, I am only a comedian and it is the worst spot to be. So if anybody wants to be successful, there's all these, like, you have to be your own boss basically.
Right.
And I just can't do that. And I suck. And so all I'm good at is even remotely good at is what you saw last night. That's the best you get at me.
Mm. There's a lot of bests off stage, too.
Hey, thanks. That's really kind of you. Thank you. But I just can't. Yeah. I know I frustrated a lot of people, though. Like, I know that, like, Doug really tried to help me for a long time, and I feel like I disappointed him because I let him down. I let a lot of people down because they put all of this. They think I'm talented and they love me, but I just can't. Follow through with. I can't. I don't know if I don't have the attention for it or the business mind or whatever. I just don't. All I'm good at is the talky part, and I need what I'm saying is I need a manager.
That's to what's running through my brain.
Just somebody that just knows
that skill, to
and I'm
help
not
you.
That I'm not going to do anything except show up probably 10 minutes late and do my business. And then I'm probably going to leave, drink some wine, and go. If I could find somebody that was happy with that, and I didn't have to do anything, then I'm good. Yeah.
Well,
but that's what I want to talk about, is that I am a total fuck up as far as comics go. I am. I'm just a big disappointment. Like, did you see what JT put together?
Oh, wow.
He's amazing. Yeah, that comedy festival is just incredible. Yeah. Like, I could never, I wouldn't even have a website. No, there would be no comics showed up because I wouldn't, I didn't ever answer a question or an email.
I talked to him about 2 months ago, and he said, you know, some people think that they should all be like me, in that, you know, they can organize things and their brain is always going. And he put it out there. No, it's just, this is how my brain is wired. So it's, you know, accepting that your brain is wired a particular way, and then just going with it and surrounding yourself with the people that help complement.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Oh, so. For sure. Yes. Yeah. I just have to accept that I have beat myself up a lot over the years for not being able to do more or follow through with stuff. And like, I forgot to renew my website. So now my website is owned by this German dude, and it's got some erectile dysfunction stuff on it. And I go, he says it's worth, he'll give me my own name. ChristineLevy.com for $895. And I said, I promise it's not worth that much. Man. I know it's not worth that much.
Man. Christine Levine Comedy. There you go.
Oh, yeah. I should just change it. Yeah. I don't even think of that.
Oh, my God. Christine.
Where have you been? I need you. Oh, God. That's so stupid.
We'll talk after
that. Oh, jeez. Okay. I got a GoDaddy account. Let's do this. Yeah.
All right. Well, I like to wrap up with the closing question. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
One word to describe your future.
Busy.
Look at you.
For real busy.
Consistent.
But right? Yeah. Like, I'm hoping.
Yeah.
I'm hoping. Yeah. And free, I think. I mean, like, I'm getting a divorce, finally, and I'm so happy. Yeah. And I am, oh, God, it's the best thing in the world. I can't even tell you. I picked up my divorce papers, and I snuggled them. I rubbed them on my face and my heart. I was like, oh, this is the best idea. Why didn't I do this 9 years ago? Yeah, it feels good. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm getting my... what is it now? Okay, so I got married. This is why I said busy, because I got married when I was 18, divorced when I was 19, married again when I was 20. Yeah, okay, so back. I married my, boy I met, like, right out of high school, right? And then got pregnant with Christopher, and then we divorced. His parents hated me. It was a nightmare. And then I met a Saudi guy, a guy from Saudi Arabia. He took me to Cairo. And then, during the first Gulf War. So then, he left me there for a year with our baby, and then just pretty much abandoned us. But I mean, he still sent money. I don't think he wasn't all the way bad, but just, I was on my own for a whole year, and I was a young little white lady, and that is a whole another hour. Anyway, and then I came home, and then I remarried the first husband, who raised my little Saudi baby as his own with Christopher. What a great guy, right? Uh-huh. Well, fast forward 18 years, then he's having an affair, online affair with StarTrek.com, and runs off to Australia. Yes, runs off to Australia, leaves us, and then he comes back 3 weeks later, tries to kill himself. Cute. Then, he goes off to the nut hut. I file for divorce because I was like, dude, for better or worse, maybe, but you left your body for my children to find. I'm done. Something's wrong, and I can't handle it. And then I met the magician, and I thought, you know, it's cute. He's creative, right? So I think it's going to be great. It's a whole mess. And then, so now I'm done. Now I just want to do comedy, and I'm just comedy and my radio show, and that's that. I don't care. I'm happy now, finally.
Good.
Yes. But so busy for other reasons now, I think. That's what I'm hoping.
Very good. All right. Well, that is a wrap on Comedy Wham Presents. Christine Levine, tell us where we can find you on social media, your up-and-coming website that you're going to...
ChristineLevineComedy.com, you genius. God damn it. Are you a writer?
Wow. I'm solutions-focused.
Yes, you are. That's great. Okay. All right. Yes, or our upcoming website. Well, right now I'm in Twitter jail. No, Facebook jail, because I called white dudes dumb. What a monster.
I tried to send you a friend request, and I was told you were over your I wonder if it's don't because worry. Of that.
No. Well, I am probably over, like, at my limit.
Oh, okay.
But don't worry. There's a MAGA head Trumpster that I will delete for you. Don't yes. worry. That's an easy.
I'm anti.
That's an easy yeah. call. So, but when I get out of Twitter, or I mean Facebook jail. Yeah. So Twitter, Christine Levine. Okay. And then Instagram, Christine Levine. I'm not very good with, I really yeah. should be more creative with my, I always am jealous of people that have great handles, but I.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think it's a safer long-term bet to go with your name.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. Okay, maybe I feel yeah. better now.
But your
about
website
that.
Will be Christine Levine Comedy.
Shit, yeah, it will be. Yeah. If that is bought by that German dude, I'm going to be so
oh,
pissed
yeah.
off. All right, we better find out.
We'll have ways to work around that.
Okay.
All right. We hope you've enjoyed learning about how Christine got to be the comedic genius that you heard today just as much as I have. Be sure to visit ComedyWham.com. Give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, all at ComedyWham. And like that Facebook page. We are not in Facebook jail. Mm-hmm. You can listen to past interviews on iTunes or your favorite podcast player and review us while you're at it. This has been Comedy Wham Presents Christine Levine. I'm Valerie, and that's been funny. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you so much for having me.